people special to God. Hi, this is Zdravko Stefanovic from Walla Walla University School of Theology. Welcome to Good Word, our weekly radio program that focuses on biblical topics and discussions. Today we are continuing a series of topics based on one of the less known books of the Bible, the Book of Numbers. To help us explore this challenging book, I have invited two of my colleagues to join me in the discussion. Dr. Kyle Craig, Professor of Chemistry at Walla Walla University, and Dr. Paul Dibdow, Professor of Religion, also here at Walla Walla University. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The chapters that we have in front of us are Numbers 5 and 6. And the first topic that I would like to discuss is this issue of the Nazirite vow. Is there a better word we can use instead of vow? How about solemn promise? And in this context, it would be making a solemn promise to God. And there were certain ways in which promises were made to God in the time of Moses. And here we have some instructions on it. So the first question would be, was a Nazirite vow a temporary or a permanent obligation?
Well, based on the section of the book of Numbers that you mentioned already, Numbers chapter 6, verse 4, in describing the expectations of the Nazirite vow, says, as long as he is a Nazirite, which would suggest that it did not have to be a permanent thing, but that it could be temporary. And my understanding that in Jewish tradition, it could be both. A person could take a permanent vow, or it could be temporary as well. It had to be at least 30 days, is my understanding, but,
And that is correct, and I believe that it's useful to emphasize this because even in the time of Moses, people would be somewhat frightened and very hesitant to make solemn promises to God that would basically tie them to those promises for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. But if that was just for a period of time, then definitely people would feel more comfortable in doing it. Mm-hmm. So I believe that that's important to emphasize because there are believers today who read these words and they also would like to commit their lives in a certain way to God for a certain period of time, and they might be hesitant to do that, thinking of all the implications to which their promise will be subject for the rest of their lives. But I believe that it's useful to emphasize this. Mm-hmm. Well, in the same passage in verse 7, it says that the symbol of the person's separation to God is mentioned. So what is behind the symbols that are mentioned here, right? Like the person was not supposed to partake of the grapes nor drink grape juice. Haircut was not allowed during that time. If that was a part of the original vow and approaching a dead body, any ideas why these were very important?
Silence here for a moment. I did think about this a little bit, and approaching a dead body, that would be connected with ritual uncleanliness. I suppose the haircuts would be a visible symbol. If you had long, your hair was allowed to grow long, people would look at you and recognize that you had taken this vow. The grapes, I can understand prohibition of alcohol, but it seems to extend beyond that. Grapes in general, even raisins, I think, were to be avoided. I'm not so sure about that one, and I'm not so sure how these three, if there's some unifying thing that I've missed. So that was a long answer to say, I don't know.
Let's listen to Kyle.
I was just going to...
Good points, by the way.
Yeah, the haircuts one, I'm at a loss to that one. I no idea. But the grapes one, maybe perhaps even the appearance of evil could be considered, or the appearance of wrongdoing, because if you aren't supposed to have the fermented form, just totally abstain, period, case closed. Don't even think about it at all, to sort of really make a stand. That's the only thing I can think of maybe for why it extended beyond just fermented stuff.
I'm sure that we'll all agree that some of these were symbols of a person's total dedication to God for a period of time, as we have said, or for the whole life. And Some of these were external signs of devotion to God, others internal. So if we go one by one, I believe that we can find two principles, and you have mentioned already some of them. One is a sense of closeness to God and nature, like growing hair, you remember Elijah and other prophets. So basically recognizing that one is a part of God's nature.
Back to nature, kind of.
Yes, because you see, for example, partaking of grapes and drinking grape juice, very often we find in the Old Testament coming in parallelism with building a house, permanent place to stay. Whereas traditionally in the Middle East, people moved, if not all the time, they were semi-nomadic, they would move from place to place. As for the dead body, I believe there is a second concept here, and that is coming closer to nature, to God, and to God who is the source of our life. So any contact with anything that is dead would kind of work in the opposite direction of it. So there were other things, for example, as we know, you know, people would sometimes sit on the dust and identify themselves, you know, with the dust of the earth, recognizing that God is powerful and that we are just a part of God's creation and so on. But that would be more a sign of mourning. But in a positive way, making promise to God and so on, many of these, once again, more likely were intended to show that even physically, the person was getting closer to God, his nature, and to God as a source of life.
Do you think there are any contemporary kinds of connections here? I mean, are there times when Christians even today should take some sort of vow, a similar kind of a vow, maybe with different identifying markers, but...
Definitely, and I'm sure, depending on the culture, there are ways in which people would recognize that that a person is doing that. And I do not know if it is correct to mention it here, but in the parts of the world where I come from, you know, very often the dress tells the society whether a person is married or not. It can tell the age of a person and a number of other things. So when it comes to religious matters, we have like the traditional churches with the orders in which people, you know, would behave that way and so on. In the New Testament setting, though, I believe that some of these may be demonstrated in a more dynamic way. And I would say that we can have somewhat, you know, the positive aspect of making a promise to God. And that is, for example, when a young person dedicates his or her life to serve God for 1 year and helping others. And you know, that's also a kind of vow and a commitment and so on. So it can be much, much broader than the Nazarite vow. So I don't see the way in which this can be literally applied today, but the principles behind it certainly can work when a person would like to dedicate oneself completely to God. One more question related to this passage is about people like Samson and John the Baptist. They were two famous Nazarites. How much do we know about female Nazarites? Because verse 1 mentions that there were female Nazarites.
I don't know much about female Nazarites. I do know that a woman's vow could be annulled by her husband or her father. But as I'm not, there may be... is someone somewhere, but I can't think of a female Nazarite mentioned in the Bible. Am I missing it somewhere?
I think that we can remember at least this much, and that is that in certain instances, when the child that was to be born was to be a Nazarite, then the restrictions of the Nazarite vow began with the mother's pregnancy.
Wouldn't you say
that?
Okay.
So that would be for
example. What the angel said to Samson's mother.
Yes.
Yeah. That's true.
Good. Well, we have another text for this week, and it comes from chapter 6, and verses 22 through 27. It's one of the most famous in the Old Testament, so I would like to request Kyle to read it, please.
Sure. Number 6, 22 to 27. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell Aaron and his sons, this is how you are to bless the Israelites. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. So they will put my name on the Israelites, and I will bless them.
Good, thank you. This is a well-known blessing that is found in the Bible, and I have a question that we could debate endlessly. Should we view blessings and curses from the Bible as prayers or as predictions?
You're right. We could talk about that for a long time. I'd say both.
Okay.
Take the middle road.
So the answer is yes.
Yes. I really like this prayer and prediction, I guess, if we're going to go that way. I remember we used to either sing this in high school or they would often sing it sometimes towards the end of the year. And I just remember the select choir at my high school would sing it. And it was just a wonderful experience. And just thinking about it again brings back lots of old memories.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what you've given us a choice here, prayers or predictions. Maybe something in the middle. I don't know. I'm sort of grappling for another word, maybe.
Instead of?
Yeah, they certainly, not just, they weren't just viewed as having power, but they seem to be powerful utterances that make a difference somehow. So, is that a prayer? It almost seems like a prophecy in the sense, not just of telling something that will happen in the future, but somehow speaking the truth from God. So I don't know exactly how to.
Now we are emphasizing one aspect of it. Yeah. The danger that I see with it is that you have a being created in God's image and likeness, and that being is locked up for the rest of his or her life because of a certain pronouncement. Uh-huh. And I believe if we push it too far that way, it may damage, you know, the concept of God's image in the person. On the other hand, I agree completely with you that they should not be taken lightly.
But it's not magic that if I say the right words over you, I curse you or whatever, then your life is, there's nothing you can do about it. I wouldn't agree with that.
Thank you. And just one more question tied to it. Are blessing pronouncements common in our culture? If they aren't, could we practice them more often?
I think maybe superficial ones are, but I don't think real, heartfelt, deep-seated ones are.
Should we have more of them, Paul?
I think so, and I think probably especially parents with their children. Mm-hmm. I think we should bless our children.
Absolutely.
And I fully agree with you. To summarize today's discussion, let's say that in Bible times, even lay people were also special to God. I'd like to thank both of my guests, Paul Dibdahl and Kyle Craig, for their contribution, as well as Susan Michael, our radio technician here. Please join us next week as we continue to explore the messages from the biblical book of Numbers. Thank you all for tuning in. For Good Word, I'm Zdravko Stefanovic.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.